We're joined here live in the KODX studios by Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. No job today. He's got surgery scheduled this weekend.
He had surgery scheduled this week.
And so he's going to be recovering from that for a little while. He may or may not be in next weekend. We'll see how things go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He had spinal surgery.
Yeah, spinal surgery to help with vertebra in his neck.
Yeah.
Which
so they took out one and they put in a replacement. Mm-hmm. And so he essentially gave a piece of his back. We don't know who it's going to specifically, but there's a politician somewhere that's going to be getting a little more spine.
We could only hope that that would be the case. My guess is that no, they were just replacing a deteriorated vertebra. That kind of happens sometimes as you age, especially if you take the types of medications he takes for his other medical conditions. You can suffer bone loss, and that was the case for him, and he needed a replacement. So he's getting a part swapped.
Yep. So we don't know when he'll be back, but we're hoping soon. But he is out and happier to be out. So.
Yeah.
All right. So diving in this week, we have a few days between now and the final budget vote at City Council. There were more developments this week.
Yeah, this week the City Council Budget Committee voted on just about all of the changes that various council members wanted to make to the budget. There were a total of 182 changes that they considered this week, and they approved 176 of them. Only 6 items were pulled out to be considered separately, and then council members added 11 more items that they wanted to discuss and talk about and vote on during the week. Of the 6 that were pulled out for further discussion, 3 were of particular note. First, the proposal to provide $3.5 million in additional funding for the LEAD diversion program, the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program. That's the program that gives low-level offenders the ability to opt for assistance for drug treatment and other assistance programs in order to divert them from the criminal justice system to keep them out of jail. Low-level offenders like folks who are arrested for possession of drugs, low-level drug dealers, prostitutes, petty theft, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. That funding program was pulled out of the budget to make changes. To be fully funded, the program, the folks who are running the program said that they needed a total of $4.8 million from the city. After 3 council members had proposed adding that total to the budget, Sally Bagshaw then proposed instead that the council allocate $3.5 million, with the remaining $1.3 million coming from private sources. The council decided to pull this item out and amend it to say where that private money is coming from. The new line item in the budget will be voted on in the coming week. It now says that private money is coming from one source, the Ballmer Group. That's a nonprofit run by former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer and his wife Connie. They set that up initially. They set up that foundation initially to make big donations to benefit charter schools and to promote the use of software and data tracking in social services programs. Which makes me kind of wonder if there aren't some conditions attached to that money that the Ballmer Group is going to provide to the LEAD program.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to find out further details on that.
So that's something to watch. Now, the second of the 3 items that I think were of a special note that were pulled out of the budget this week was Council Member Lisa Herbold's request that the city come up with a plan for how to implement the city's income tax if the state Supreme Court rules to uphold it. This was pulled out of the budget to reword it to say that the city needs to study it to either how the city is going to implement it if the state Supreme Court upholds it, or to list the next steps that the city and the city council would need to take if the court decides to overturn it. So that was a kind of a small change, but it's a big item.
I saw in this morning's paper they had an article about Attorney General Ferguson basically coming out on the side of the state, saying that Seattle really doesn't have a case here.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, we'll see. I think there was also an article this week, too, where Attorney General Ferguson came out and said that Washington State and the city of Seattle and other local municipalities didn't really have a case in terms of I-976, the Tim Iman $30 car tab tax.
All right. Actually, you're right.
I think that was the article.
You're correct.
But, you know, it is the duty of the state attorney general's office to defend laws that are passed by the legislature and by citizen initiative. So we'll see where that goes. They may make a really good defense of it. They may make a half-hearted defense, but we'll see what the state Supreme Court rules in that case. But no, I don't think he actually came out against the city's income tax. I think everybody is rooting for that to pass.
Sit corrected.
And that was something we saw when I-976 passed, that one of the key things that I found very interesting was the response of not just local politicians, but state politicians in the state legislature and in the state government saying, okay, well, now that I-976 is passed, it's more urgent than ever that the state have a state income tax of some kind on the books. So I think that's something we're going to have to look forward, something that we'll be looking forward to in January when the state legislature convenes for its next session. Democrats control both the House and the Senate, and that may be one of the big topics that they decide to tackle this year, is whether or not is to restructure of the state's revenue base. In other words, looking at whether the state can institute a state income tax.
Yeah, long overdue, but just based on the city council race this year, you can anticipate that businesses and folks like the Gates and Bezos families will be pushing hard against any changes there.
Well, I don't necessarily know about that, whether that's true or not. We'll just have to see. I think even some large corporations with the passage of I-976 and all the money that they put in to try to defeat it, because it would have such a big impact on transportation funding, and the fact that, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later this morning too, the fact that so many of their employees now take transit and rely on transit, it's become a big issue for the mainstream business community now. Is the state providing adequate infrastructure and support for their workers to get to and from work and to deal with becoming insane commute times for a lot of employees in and out of the city of Seattle, but also in and out of Bellevue and other areas in the Puget Sound region, Tacoma, for example, too, where there are a lot of major employers now trying to get their employees to and from work. I think we might be surprised to see how much business support there is behind instituting an income tax. Now, I think where we're going to see businesses trying to lobby on this issue is trying to prevent a business income tax or make that business income tax be as small as they possibly can. Because income taxes can be levied on individual residents living in an area like a city or a state or the United States. But, you know, there's also the income taxes that can be levied on businesses as well. So I think that's where we might see the lobbying emphasis on the part of corporations is, yes, let's do an individual income tax, but let's not do a business income tax. So I think that's also an issue we'll have to keep in mind as we move forward on that. So, and now the third item, getting back to the city's budget, the third item that was pulled out of the city's budget for further discussion was the $1.2 million to add one new tiny home village. That was pulled over the proviso part of the proposal. Sally Bagshaw had unilaterally added a proviso to this item that spaces in the new shelter would have to be prioritized to take referrals from the lead diversion program, the navigation team, and the Seattle Municipal Court. She also snuck in a new change just at the end of last week, and just before she released the new updated version of the budget early this week, she snuck in a new change that would allow the money to be spent not just for tiny home villages, but it also includes the wording and or enhanced shelters. Shama Sawant objected to the proviso language, and she said that the only people she has ever heard who speak in favor of enhanced shelters are politicians, not the homeless themselves or homeless service providers. In fact, the privacy protections of tiny homes are proving to be a really essential part of the help that tiny home villages give to homeless people. It really helps them get their lives stabilized and get ready for permanent housing, the ability to have a private space to lock up their belongings, which you don't have nearly as much of that in an enhanced shelter as you would in a tiny home village, which begins to give you, and not just a place to lock up your belongings, but a place to be alone and mm-hmm. to focus and to concentrate on the next steps you need to take to get your life in order. Lisa Herbold and Shama Sawant are going to be working on revising the wording in that budget proviso on that line item over the weekend. And it's going to be voted on at the council's meeting this coming Monday. We'll have to see if they can make a change, because I really feel like this is a way that Bagshaw is saying, you know, that she really supports Mayor Durkin's vision of enhanced shelters as the way to go to deal with the homeless population, whereas the real statistics are showing that the tiny home villages are the most efficient way and the best way and probably the most humane way to help people get in off the street. And that's what Shama Sawant, Teresa Mosqueda, who originally proposed the money, about $600,000 to $800,000 for one tiny home village, and Lisa Herbold are really, really pushing for the city putting their resources to what works rather than what politicians think might be the most politically palatable project that they can sell to the business community and to more conservative individuals and wealthy donors in Seattle. Now, of the 11 additional items that city council members introduced this week, most of them were items that were proposed earlier by the individual council members that Sally Bagshaw had left out of the budget. 7 of the 11 were approved, including 2 items each that were proposed by Mike O'Brien and Abel Pacheco, and 1 by Lisa Herbold. Those 5 items were all approved. Shama Sawant's proposed a total of 6 items. She proposed the most of any of the city council members because, of course, I think Sally Bagshaw had cut out more of her proposals than any of the other council members. And only 2 of Shama Sawant's items were approved. The 2 that were statements of intent that included no changes in the spending within the budget. The 4 that were rejected involved large amounts and moving large amounts of money around in the budget. That included cutting an additional $222,000 in funding from the Seattle Police Department's $1.6 million recruitment and retention programs to pay instead for youth diversion programs run by groups like Youth Consortium, Creative Justice, the Rainier Beach Action Coalition, and others. Originally, Sawant had proposed cutting $522,000 from the SPD's recruitment and retention programs, but Sally Bagshaw found $300,000 for these programs from another part of the budget. Sawant proposed this to bring the funding up to what she had originally proposed of $522,000. She said, well, you know, if you only found $300 elsewhere in the budget, let's go ahead and cut this $222,000. And that item didn't garner support from a majority of other council members. The second item that was rejected was Sawant's proposal to cut the entire funding, the $8.4 million budget for the navigation team, and spend that money instead on building 14 new tiny home villages. Originally, Sawant had proposed also cutting $200,000 that was devoted for dismantling and or relocating the North Lake Tiny Home Village, which is currently self-governed. And which has been resisting efforts by the city to take over governance with the help of Lehigh. The city is now saying that they won't need that $200,000 next year because they expect the North Lake Village to be dismantled by the end of this year. That's why that wasn't in her proposal. And that proposal that Sawant made for cutting all of the funding for the navigation team and putting it to tiny home villages didn't garner support from the other council members. The third item that was rejected was Sawant's proposal to cut $607,000 from the Seattle Police Department's hiring bonus fund, which totals $814,000, and to use that money to fund renter organizing and outreach. $100,000 would have been used for LGBTQ seniors. $107,000 would have gone towards Know Your Rights forums, such as those run by B Seattle. $200,000 would have gone to the Tenants Union of Washington to fund building-based tenant associations, and $200,000 would have been spent on direct outreach to renters. That, as I said, didn't get a majority support from other council members. And then the fourth item was a proposal to cut $304,000 of money carrying forward from last year's Seattle Department of Transportation budget that was devoted for congestion pricing efforts, and to move that money to the Department of Construction and Inspections to spend on legal representation for tenants facing eviction. Sawant had already managed to win an increase in that funding from $64,522 up to $230,522. This additional amount that she proposed would have brought the total to $534,522. But again, that additional $300,000 didn't gain support from other council members. So even though these four items were defeated, there were some incremental gains that Sawant made from proposing these big items. As I said, she did gain $300,000 increase in funding for youth diversion programs that Bagshaw went back to the budget and dug out and found for him. She did gain a tripling of funds for tenants facing eviction. That is a positive move. Mm-hmm. And she did find an additional $1.2 million in funding for the construction of one new tiny home village. If Sawant and Herbold can ensure that the funds get set aside for that purpose only, instead of also being earmarked by Bagshaw at the last minute to be available for enhanced shelters too. So we'll see how that works next Monday when the council votes on these final budget changes. Now, the seven proposals that passed, the seven additional proposals that passed include some interesting changes. Mike O'Brien requested that the city issue a report on how it will move to 100% electrification of transportation and buildings by 2030, which is part of the Green New Deal, which the City Council passed this year. So that did pass. O'Brien also proposed that the city issue proposed rules that would prevent new fossil fuel processing and storage facilities within the city limits. That also did pass with a majority. In a similar action, Abel Pacheco allocated $63,000 for the Department of Construction and Inspections to make changes and updates to the city's green building standards. That also won a majority support. Lisa Herbold proposed a revised and smaller version of one of Sawant's rejected proposals, moving $25,000 from the congestion pricing account in the Seattle Department of Transportation and $35,000 from the Seattle Police Department for hiring one administrative assistant, and taking that money and then spending that $60,000 for renter organizing and outreach. So Lisa Herbold did manage to win an additional $60,000 for one of Sawant's big proposals that didn't make it through. So that's where having allies on the city council can help you, and having more progressive folks sit on the city council can actually help move some improvements through. Mm-hmm. The more interesting of Sawant's two non-revenue items that were passed is her request for the Seattle Department of Transportation to prepare a draft plan and budget for implementing free transit in Seattle. So yes, the city will study this and will come up with a proposal and a feasibility study to see can we get to free transit in Seattle? What will it take? How much will it cost? So I thought that was a nice positive thing to be in the budget. So this, just to remind folks, the City Council Budget Committee will hold its final meeting at 10 a.m. on Monday morning to take public testimony and vote on the last small changes to the budget, including those three items that I highlighted earlier that were pulled out to make final changes. And then they'll take a vote to pass the full budget bill out of committee. When that's done, the full council will take a break, and then they'll reconvene at 2 p.m. on Monday to vote on the various bills that make up the final city budget and the capital budget package. There's a bunch of bills that have to be passed for that to happen. Not just the revenue budget that says, you know, here are the line items, here's what we're spending in each department on each item, but also various other bills that came out of the budgetary process that says, okay, if we're setting up this new program, we have to pass a bill to to authorize it, et cetera. We need to make certain changes in the city code for various things. So the city council will be voting, they'll start voting on those on Monday afternoon.
Okay. So is it worth then for people to show up at the 9:30, 10 a.m. meeting to have input there?
Yeah, I think it is for the important for them to show up around 9:30 for the 10 a.m. budget meeting, especially if they support the devotion of that $1.2 million to tiny home villages only, rather than to make those also available for tiny home villages and or enhanced shelters, to say, okay, there's enough money in the budget for enhanced shelters. Let's focus on what works. Let's put the money to that. I think that's a particularly important thing
especially
to do.
In light of that, the tiny home villages appear to be being shut down, you know, if you look at
with the shutdown of the North Lake tiny home village, that it's also, I think, important for the city council and the city government to hear people support self-governance and steps that allow homeless folks to take control of their lives. And that includes supporting the tiny home villages and to support self-governance in the tiny home villages.
And as nice as it is, and critical as it is to have in the tiny home villages, to be able to lock your stuff, you know.
And to have a place of your own where you can sit and and work on your own issues and your own things that you have to do in order to get your life under control.
Right. So you can go to your job, which many people do have jobs.
Get prepared for work. Yeah, a lot of homeless. A surprising number of people who are homeless have steady work.
But to also be in again, as you had already pointed out, to also be in a place, to be living in a place where you have some degree of input into the process, you know, democratic process there, which in the alternatives that Sally Bagshaw is proposing, that isn't always the case.
Yeah. And, I think the city undervalues the importance of community. You know, I mean, one of the big steps for people coming in off the street is finding a community and getting into a place where they feel that what they have to say matters, that they can pick up and do volunteer tasks that help them develop skills that can help them get a better job, not just get a job, because a lot of them do have jobs, but help to. That can help them learn what skills they may have that they haven't been able to marshal to get a better job, and to give them a sense that they have more control over their lives and the environment around them, that they're not just kind of blowing in the wind, you know what I'm saying? So community is a very, very important part of the tiny home village concept. Enhanced shelters, you can, I think, feel like you're a product being pushed through a mill that's shaping you to fit, you know, into society. You don't always feel like you have control or a say and a voice. You don't necessarily develop skills that might help you really, really discover what some of your strengths and weaknesses are, to help you sort of understand, you know, do I have other sort of community skills that I can leverage into a better job? You know, I don't think you get that in an enhanced shelter. You tend to feel more like you're a product being squeezed through an assembly line, I think.
And hence the why a lot of the businesses, well, not maybe a lot, but some of the businesses that are getting involved in this process, that are interested in pitching in, also happen to be pitching products. You know,
yes.
And
yes.
That was actually some of the items that were rejected early on.
Yeah, it's much, much easier for them to do that in an enhanced shelter setting that's run by the city. It's much, much harder for them to do that.
Yeah, we've got a nifty
that.
Piece of software that we think you ought to be
using.
Yeah, we
have a tracking software we think you should use. We have, you know, a training program referral software package we want you to use. You know, whether or not those software packages work or help, I don't think that they necessarily help the folks who should be the main focus of the city's time, energy, and monetary resources, and that's the homeless folks themselves. Now, it's important, too, in this whole budget process for people to remember that overall the city council has made some really significant and positive changes to the city budget this year. They allocated over $4 million in funding for homelessness services that weren't in Mayor Durkin's initial proposal. The council moved to begin spending $12.75 million in Mercer Mega Block proceeds for affordable housing projects that are shovel-ready today. They'll be spending that money in 2020 instead of sitting on it in a fund trying to determine what, you know, what kind of land the city should buy, how we should spend this, et cetera, which was Mayor Durkin's proposal. They allocated $1.5 million for hygiene services for the homeless in Seattle that wasn't in Mayor, that weren't in Mayor Durkin's budget. They allocated $3.5 million to fund 54 new caseworkers for the LEAD diversion program to keep low-level offenders out of jail and get them drug treatment and services to divert them from the poverty to prison pipeline. And that's something that should have been, really should have been in Durkin's budget, and it's kind of inexcusable that it wasn't. They continued oversight of the navigation team, so Lisa Herbold's budget provisos to continue oversight of the navigation team and continue questioning, is the navigation team effective? What do they actually do?
So is that the quarterly reports? That's the quarterly reports, yeah.
They added $1.9 million in funding for food programs recommended by the Sweetened Beverage Tax Advisory Board. That was primarily Lisa Herbold's effort. They added $1.5 million to help the Roots Youth Homeless Shelter move to a new space. That's in there. Funding to operate an overnight safe parking lot at the University Heights Community Center for homeless folks living in RVs and cars.
That's
in the budget. They allocated $2 million of Mercer Mega Block proceeds to build out the projects listed in the Bicycle Master Plan. That was Michael Bryan's baby, and that's in there. They requested that the city produce a plan and budget for building the City Connector streetcar in case the city doesn't receive federal funding for it, and that the Seattle Department of Transportation will now have to provide that plan to the City Council by September 1st, 2020. That was Lisa Herbold's request, and that is in the budget. They allocated $136,000 to get the Green New Deal Oversight Board up and running. That was, I believe that was another proposal from Mike O'Brien that won majority support from the City Council members. So there's some very good things in the budget and very good changes that the City Council made that you look at these changes and you think, duh, why didn't Durkin propose some of these things? Well, that's what the City Council's for, to plug the gaps and to and because they know the nitty-gritty day-to-day of the work of the city, particularly folks who've been there for quite a few years, like Lisa Herbold, and before she was on council, she was Nick Licata's aide, who've been watching this process for decades.
Well, and the city council is their constituents are citizens in their district and citywide, and Durkin's
and
constituents are people in towers.
Yeah, and people can come forward and say, why isn't there more money for elder care, or why isn't there more money for youth, you know, and can spotlight things like, you know, we're losing a youth shelter. Can the city throw in any funds to help this shelter relocate and reopen, you know, because they're losing, their landlord's kicking them out? You know, those kind of things are things that constituents can take to their city council members, and it really makes a big difference in determining where the city spends its money and what services it provides. So let's
anything else on that?
No, let's move to some other local news.
All right, commuting.
Yeah, the Seattle Times had an interesting article this week in a column by the FYI guy Gene Balk at the Seattle Times. He looked at recent census data, which shows that of the largest 100 cities in the United States, Seattle has seen the biggest decrease in commuting by car than any other big city in the U.S. The percentage of folks, single drivers, who commute to work in Seattle is down 8.9% since 2010. That's the largest drop in the nation. The second largest drop is in the city of Tacoma, which saw an 8% decrease. And then the third highest drop is San Francisco with a 5.7% decrease. So our 9% decrease in the city of Seattle is ahead of other cities in the nation by a lot. and I found that very, very interesting. In 2018, just 44% of Seattle residents, or about 197,000 people, drove to work by car alone, by car. Over 23% used transit. That's a 5% increase from 2010. That's well over 100,000 people now, and probably the first time since we've been measuring it that it's over 100,000 people. Of those, 89,000 took the bus. Nearly 10,000 took light rail, which had the biggest increase in ridership in the city. The rest took the Sounder train and other transit options.
The light rail increase occurred, this is from 2010 to...
2010 to, okay. to 2018, right. Yeah.
I mean, did light rail even exist really in prior to 2010?
Well, yeah. And then, but I think the biggest increase happened when they opened the University District and Capitol Hill stations. Now,
yeah, the Husky Stadium station. I mean,
well, and forcing people who want to get to the U District from downtown to either take a slow 70 bus or to hop on the light rail and then take a bus from there or walk into the U District. I think once they open the station that's in the heart of the U District and the Northgate
station,
it'll
dramatically change.
They're going to have to start running larger trains and more frequently.
But again, if they had, and we talked about it back when it happened, but the Husky Stadium station, the way they made that so popular is by killing off numerous bus lines.
You
really had no other way of getting into town if you didn't have a car.
Yeah, that's true. Driving is still the leading form of commuting in Seattle, with transit number two. My question is, what would you guess would be number three on that list, Mike?
I'm sorry, give me the choices again.
So when it comes to commuting to work, driving's number one, transit's number two. What do you think is number three?
You have bicycles or walking, so I'm going to say bicycles.
No, you're wrong. It's walking.
Okay.
In our hilly city, we have 54,000 people who walk to work, and that includes me. I walk to my job every day.
Yeah, I do too.
That's 12% of the total. Seattle also has the biggest increase in walkers among the largest 100 U.S. cities, an 8.6% increase since 2010. That's almost as high as the increase as the decrease in people who drive to work alone. And this, I think, is partly driven by the construction of new apartments and condo buildings in downtown, Belltown, South Lake Union, the Central District, the International District, and other areas that are neighborhoods that are close in to downtown and other job centers.
Well, and a side note there, it's also driven by construction, because there's so much construction going on that it blocks your routes to like do things like park a car or find a bus stop that has been moved several blocks because
moving around.
Yeah,
I know.
I mean, it's a friggin' nightmare.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And the city has been de-emphasizing parking in a lot of neighborhoods, so that's also, I think, one of the reasons why more people are walking. Notably, only three other cities have a higher percentage of people who walk to work, and those cities are Boston, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco, cities where walking has traditionally been pretty common. So for the remaining commuters in Seattle, 7.7% work at home or work from home. 6.9% of Seattle residents carpool, and that number is actually decreasing, I think, as more people take transit and transit becomes more frequent and reliable. And 3.8% bike to work. And the folks who bike to work, that's 16,800 people who have been getting on their bicycles on the streets through hot sun, pouring rain, and in a lot of neighborhoods, increasingly intense traffic with not necessarily a protected bike lane available in a lot of city streets yet. So that's still a lot of people riding their bikes to work. But I think when the city finally builds out its protected bike lane network, that amount is going to jump dramatically, just like it has when building out the light rail lines.
I would be curious to know if the different short-range bike rental programs that we have in town factor into those numbers at all, or if they're just primarily people that are using those are for
point-to-point
entertainment-type rides.
Or tourist rides, It would be interesting to see that information. That would be a different study. Now, I also want to point out, too, the statistics for commuting into downtown Seattle are quite different from the statistics for commuting to work throughout Seattle. So those two are very different. A study done by Commute Seattle showed that in 2017, 48% of downtown workers took transit to work. That was the biggest number. That's the vast majority of downtown workers. Only 25% drive alone. And I think the main reason for that is the cost of parking and the lack of availability of parking in downtown, as well as just overall congestion. Carpooling only accounts for another 10% of downtown workers, while 8% walk, 3% ride their bikes, and 6% travel by some other means into downtown. And you might ask, what would those other means be? Well, think about people who take taxis, who maybe rely on Uber and Lyft. Some folks skateboard. Some may kayak to work. Some take the ferry. So there are a lot of different ways that folks can commute into downtown. And I think the more you get out of your car, the more fun it is, actually, to commute in a different way. After all, Commute Seattle also pointed out that downtown Seattle saw an increase in 60,000 jobs from 2010 to 2017. That's almost 9,000 more jobs every single year. And there's just not enough room to park all those cars, and there's not enough room on our city streets for 9,000 new jobs in downtown every single year.
Mm. And there doesn't appear to be enough room on the bus half the time.
Half the time, yeah. Jobs. And that's where the issue of I-976 really hits hard. You know, cutting money for transit, how does that make sense when you have 9,000 new people trying to get into a restricted space every single year? You have to have more transit, and it has to run more frequently, and it just does not make sense to cut funding for it. Now, on that note, Sound mm-hmm. Transit announced this week, they didn't officially announce, but it appeared from Thursday's Sound Transit board meeting that Sound Transit plans to keep collecting car tab fees regardless of I-976. And board chairman John Marchioni made it clear that Sound Transit will not be filing a lawsuit against I-976 anytime soon. Instead, the board is planning to rely on advice from their legal counsel that the initiative didn't set a deadline for the early payoff of the $2.3 billion in bond debt that Sound Transit has already accumulated to build out phase two of the Sound Transit light rail system and phase three. Now, when those bonds were sold, the sales terms specified that Sound Transit would collect car tab fees to pay off the bonds over time. I-976 doesn't, however, provide an accelerated payoff schedule for those bonds. So Sound Transit legal counsel is arguing that, well, doesn't apply. I-976 doesn't really apply to Sound Transit. It was poorly worded legally. Those bond contracts supersede it. So even if the courts don't impose an injunction by December 5th and I-976 goes into effect, Sound Transit is assuming that they'll still be able to levy and collect their portion of the car tab fees. And that may spark a lawsuit by Tim Iman or supporters of I-976. Now, currently, the state of Washington, the city of Seattle, and several other municipalities in the state are suing to overturn I-976. If the courts rule against them, then Sound Transit will still be able to file its own lawsuit, but currently they're not planning to do so. Right now, they seem to think that they don't need to do anything.
That seems... Well, clarify for me. It seems odd that so they mechanically get those fees from when you are purchasing your car tabs, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and the car tabs and everything, isn't that done through the state of Washington? So how does a county or in multi-counties leverage that, you know, when the state is the one printing up the documents and using their computers to process that? I'm just curious.
That's a very good question. I'll be curious to see how Sound Transit works that out with the state of Washington.
Maybe they have a team of hackers that go in and modify things.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the state of Washington is going to be much more sympathetic to Sound Transit's legal arguments than they're going to be to Tim Eymann's I-976. So I don't think the Sound Transit has a very high bar to get over to persuade the state of Washington to continue collecting the fees on their behalf. I think that's going to be a pretty easy thing for them to do. I'm sure their lawyers will be presenting their legal arguments to the state in order to get that to continue. And I think the state's going to be pretty sympathetic to that. So,
all right. Mm-hmm. Well,
and then finally, Tim Eymann, at that same Sound Transit board meeting on Thursday, Tim Eymann announced his candidacy. Not for U.S. president, thank God. You know, I don't think we could survive that, and we don't need that kind of craziness. Eymann stood up at the Sound Transit board meeting and announced that he will run for governor next year of the state of Washington against Jay Inslee, who will be running for his third term. Of course, if Tim Eymann didn't have time because his microphone got cut off, Sound Transit has rules that if you're speaking at a meeting, you can't stand up and advocate for your own campaign. But Eymann didn't say whether or not he was going to run as a Republican. My guess is he probably will. Before he goes head-to-head with Inslee, then, if he declares as a Republican, he's going to have to beat the three other Republicans who've announced that they're running for governor. And that includes Senator Phil Fortunato of Auburn, the former mayor of Bothell and real estate developer Joshua Freed, and also includes Lauren Culp, who's the police chief of the tiny town of Republic in eastern Washington. Those folks will, I'm sure, make a big deal out of Tim Eymann's legal troubles because he's currently being sued by the state of Washington for stealing money donated to his initiative campaigns and using it instead to buy stuff for himself and pay his personal expenses. So he has that to overcome before he can run against Jay Inslee. But I thought that was kind of interesting right after Sound Transit basically said, well, Sound Transit board members basically said, no, we're just not going to honor I-976. We're going to honor the legal contracts that Sound Transit signed to issue these bonds. He stands up and just kind of impulsively says, well, I'm running for governor. Mm. Yeah, I found that kind of interesting.
And potentially pursuing a campaign motto that he'll make the watches run on time.
Yeah, and you know, we'll see too how his lawsuits, how the current lawsuits against him impact his race for governor, because there are all kinds of different punishments that if he loses those lawsuits, the state may try to impose, and one of them may be making it more difficult for him to collect donations for a campaign. And if you're running for governor, you need a lot of money behind you. So we'll just see how it works out.
All right. Moving on to national, and lots of time spent this week with impeachment hearings.
Yeah, the public hearings concluded with a busy week of witnesses. I just want to mention too, Mike, you aired a lot of the impeachment.
We were carrying the Pacifica coverage of it. Mm-hmm. Some of Tom Hartman was covering it. So we had many hours.
Yeah. I just want to kind of talk a little bit about some of the things that stood out for me. I didn't actually watch the hearings. Mike, you listened to them quite a bit. So feel free to jump in and give your impressions too.
All right.
I followed the news coverage of the hearings afterwards and read some quotations of what the different witnesses said. And what stood out for me was some of the following. On Tuesday, was Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He gave his public testimony that he was alarmed by the July phone call in which Donald Trump demanded that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky investigate the Bidens and Burisma, the natural gas company that Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, was on the board of. Trump wanted Zelensky to investigate the Bidens and Burisma in exchange for U.S. military aid in a meeting up with Donald Trump in the White House. the Republicans do their best to try to tear down Vindman's credibility. Republican Jim Jordan in particular, that's the former wrestling coach from Ohio, he tried to imply that Vindman's boss, Fiona Hill, had criticized his job performance. But Vindman was prepared for that. He pulled out a copy of his latest job performance evaluation from July, and he read Fiona Hill's positive comments aloud to the committee. Later in the week, in her own testimony, Fiona Hill would confirm that she never questioned Vindman's judgment. So it's unclear to me where that idea that she as Vindman's boss would have been critical of him in the first place.
Yeah, Jim Jordan was very excited throughout the week. It was pretty entertaining watching how excited, hyper, energetic at least the three primary Republican representatives on the Intelligence Committee were, especially given how much going back to like the Kavanaugh hearings, you know, mm-hmm. and the portrayal of the women get very emotional during these things, and the guys are this stalwart, even keeled. It was like, this week was this, this week, and as we saw partly last week, it was just the complete opposite of that. So,
it's important to remember too that the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee were not the Republicans initially chosen by the party leadership to sit on the Intelligence Committee. Just before these hearings, the Republicans did a major reshuffle to find the biggest supporters, the most vocal, and the most kind of able to appeal to the knee-jerk emotional reactions of Republican supporters. And they pushed those folks to be the ones to sit on the committee, including Jim Jordan.
Yeah, they did a reshuffle and they grabbed the two Joker cards and the jacks, you know, put them up there in front. So
yeah. Now they also and the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee were also allowed to have lawyers there to ask questions. The Republicans' main lawyer, Steve Castor, tried to imply that Colonel Vindman was disloyal to the U.S. because, you know, he's an immigrant who was born in the Ukraine and came to the U.S. when he was 3 years old. You know, pretty typical xenophobic Republican stuff. And as you know, Vindman speaks a foreign language, or I should say another language other than English. And that makes him suspect in the eyes of Republicans. And they never really ever explain why. It's just a part of their sort of xenophobic thing. And it is really a dog whistle to the far right racist anti-immigrant wing of the Republican Party. And I found that to be really slimy. And I'm sure there were a lot of folks who were listening to the hearings because the hearings, it turns out, have been very, very popular. It's hard to measure how many millions of people in the U.S. were listening to the hearings. But we know that on live TV, which takes those kinds of statistics, the listenership was at least 12 million. With another, I would argue another 10 to 12 probably online, if not more than that, listening via live streaming.
Although,
and on cable,
yeah,
you know,
we
can't really measure the number of people who listen on the radio.
Right, but one of the things I liked about doing the Pacifica coverage was they had Mitch Jezerich and a couple other people co-hosting and would do good analysis during the breaks and give you critical information that I found really valuable. I don't know how much of that they do on the corporate media television that was covering it and or C-SPAN, if they did any there.
C-SPAN doesn't typically do that, but
they do take calls sometimes. But again, yeah,
cable,
during the hearings, yeah.
On cable shows like, you know, on cable stations like Fox and CNN and MSNBC, you would without a doubt have analysts talking during the breaks about the testimony.
So it really helped to get this. Some other people weighing in as to what you just heard and filling in some of the blanks.
And some of the background.
Yeah. Especially on the people who were questioning those who were, you know, being questioned.
Yeah. Now, what also stuck out for me was while Vindman was testifying, the White House Twitter account, not the Twitterer in chief, but the official taxpayer-funded account posted the following, quote, Tim Morrison, Alexander Vindman's former boss, testified in his deposition that he had concerns about Vindman's judgment, end quote. So now I want to point out, first off, that Tim Morrison wasn't his direct boss. That was Fiona Hill. But also that this really shows that now the official White House Twitter feed is being used to intimidate witnesses, not just Donald Trump doing that directly. He's managed somehow to get the official feed to do his dirty work for him. Now, also standing out for me was on Tuesday evening, after the committee took Vindman's testimony, they brought in testimony from two witnesses that were requested by the Republicans on the committee. They have the ability to bring in their own witnesses. They requested Tim Morrison, the National Security Council's former senior director for Russia and Europe, and Kurt Volker, the former special envoy to the Ukraine. But instead of helping the Republicans, Morrison and Volker actually seemed to support the Democrats' investigation. Morrison agreed that he suppressed the transcript of the July call because he thought it would be politically damaging to Donald Trump if it was released. So there he was essentially saying, yep, we did this because we for political reasons. And that, of course, implies that there was something in that call that was politically improper or politically explosive. All right. Now, Volker, on the other hand, was Volker, in addition, was openly hostile to the Republicans' defense. And I just want to read one of his quotes. Quote, I don't think that raising 2016 elections or Vice President Biden or these things I consider to be conspiracy theories that have been circulated by the Ukrainians are things that we should be pursuing as part of our national security strategy with Ukraine. Now, note, that's the end of the quote. Now, note the use of Biden's title, Vice President. Volker also called Biden at one point an honorable man. So these are the witnesses that the Republicans produce, supposedly to bolster Donald Trump and to bolster their conspiracy theories. And one of them tried to just turned around and said, look, what you're proposing in defense of Donald Trump is a conspiracy theory. It's not helpful. And the other one said, well, yeah, there was something politically wrong with that call that Donald Trump made. So I thought that was worth reminding folks of. Also on Wednesday was Gordon Sondland's turn in the hearings. Sondland, remember, had no diplomatic experience before he was made ambassador to the Ukraine by Donald Trump in return for the $1 million that Sondland had donated to Trump's campaign. Sondland is one of the three amigos. That's the nickname for the three folks who were working on Donald Trump's behalf on trying to get the president of the Ukraine to start up investigations into the Bidens. Those three people were Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, and Sondland. Now, Sondland confirmed in his testimony not only that there was a quid pro quo, but he also implicated Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, National Security Advisor John Bolton, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in that effort, too. He showed the committee incriminating emails, and he implied that the White House had withheld a lot more emails, text messages, and other documents that were also incriminating and perhaps more incriminating. At one point, Sondland said, quote, everyone was in the loop, end quote. So that really stood out for me, Sondland's. Now the Republicans might say, and some of the Democrats too might say, Sondland's not exactly credible because he said multiple times, "I don't really remember what happened. I don't really remember
this or
that."
Yeah, he's kind of modified things over time,
and he's changed his testimony, saying that his memory isn't great about the specifics. But I think overall, you know, it's hard not to remember who was in the loop and who was not on something like this. And I think Sondland really was damaging for Donald Trump's case. Laura Cooper, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia and the Ukraine, and David Hale, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, both testified on Wednesday, too. They cast doubt on Donald Trump's assertion that the Ukrainians didn't even know that there was a hold on the military aid. Cooper in particular said that one of her staff took a call from a Ukrainian embassy contact on July 25th, shortly after Trump's call with Zelensky. And the Ukrainian contact wanted to know what was happening with the military aid now that Zelensky had agreed, yes, we will do the investigations. So it was pretty clear from her testimony and from Hale's testimony that that Donald Trump's assertions that, and the Republicans' assertions that, the Ukrainians didn't even know there was a hold on the aid, that's not true. On Thursday were the two final and very important witnesses, Fiona Hill, the former specialist in Russian and European affairs on the National Security Council, and David Holmes. Now, I want to point out that Fiona Hill was also an aide to former National Security Advisor John Bolton. She worked with him pretty closely on this, and her testimony drove a nail in the coffin of the Republican conspiracy theories by saying, and this is a direct quote from her, quote, "Based on questions and statements I have heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves," end quote. So in essence, she was saying, to the Republicans on the committee and all the other Republicans in Congress who are supporting Donald Trump by trying to defend his indefensible behavior, that they've become dupes of the Russian security services. That's essentially what she was saying.
Yeah, she was very impressive. She just made short work of anyone that was questioning her.
She gave very necessary contextual background for all of this stuff and for what the Three Amigos were doing on behalf of Donald Trump's personal political future. Now, on Thursday also, the hearings were wrapped up with David Holmes. He's the political counsel at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. He recounted his restaurant meeting with Gordon Sondland, where Sondland took a call from Donald Trump. Trump, in that phone call, spoke so loudly that Sondland had to hold the phone away from his ear. And unlike what Donald Trump tweeted, many of us have had that, where we're talking to somebody who's so loud you have to pull the phone away from your ear, and other people in the room can hear what the other person is saying on your phone. That's a very common thing. Donald Trump is lying once again when he says that is impossible. Now, in addition, Holmes testified about other phone calls and meetings in which various members of the Three Amigos, their support staff, and other members of the White House openly discussed the Trump administration shakedown of Ukrainian President Zelensky. The Republicans, of course, tried again to advance their conspiracy theories, but I think Holmes was pretty successful in making them look like fools. What was your impression, Mike?
I actually didn't hear a lot of the
Holmes
testimony.
Yeah,
couldn't tell you.
But I think if you were going to pick testimony to go back and listen to, I would pick Thursday's testimony by Hill and Holmes. For people
again,
to listen to.
Fiona Hill was amazing.
Yeah. So the question is, what next now that the public testimony appears to be closed? The House is in recess this week because of the Thanksgiving holiday. When they come back from their recess, the House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff will compile a report of the investigation and submit it to the House Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee will review the report and decide whether to draft articles of impeachment and what those articles will be. So far, there's no set timeline on how long that process is going to take. Some Democrats are saying they would like to vote on impeachment before the end of the year. If that happens and the House votes to impeach, the Senate would then have to hold a trial. But it looks like the soonest that might happen would be in January. And of course, there could always be more witnesses who come forward to testify, which would delay this whole process. Interestingly, Donald Trump has said he's willing to answer questions in writing, just like he did for Robert Mueller's investigation. But, his lawyers may put a stop to that, given that the answers that Trump gave to Robert Mueller could now be something that has put him into legal jeopardy, now that evidence in Roger Stone's trial has contradicted much of what Donald Trump wrote in his written testimony to the Mueller investigation, and that the difference between what Donald Trump wrote and what came out in Stone's trial could be one element of the impeachment articles that the House draws up later this year.
All right.
Okay.
Events.
Yeah, so events that are coming up this week. I just want to remind folks that the Friday after Thanksgiving is Buy Nothing Day. So I know there's usually a frenzy of folks trying to get good deals that seem good in the moment. And then after you've bought it, there's a lot of buyer's remorse. So if you want to make a statement against consumerism and corporate urges, corporations urging you to go into debt to make Christmas all about the stuff rather than about being with family and friends, take part in Buy Nothing Day on Friday. Now, also Friday, November 29th, is the forum Black Lives on the Front Line, Climate Justice Discussions. That's hosted by Fridays for Future Seattle and Garfield High School's Black Student Union. Those forums start at 9:30 a.m. on Friday, November 29th, and they run to 12:30 p.m. They're at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca. And then next weekend, Saturday, November 30th, is the 20th anniversary of the protests that shut down the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, also known as the Battle of Seattle, and some of us old-timers call it N30. There's a bunch of events on that day. The Community Alliance for Global Justice has stepped up to organize a full day of programs, starting with a forum in the morning, Another World is Possible, WTO 20 Years Later, with speakers who were at the 1999 protests, followed by workshops. That's being hosted by Community Alliance for Global Justice, United Food and Commercial Workers 21, and Town Hall Seattle. That's from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca. And when that forum is done, there will be a street party. WTO shut it down, didn't we? A 20th anniversary celebration with guerrilla photos and video projections and music from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. outside the Washington State Convention Center at 7th and Pike, where the WTO was trying to meet that day 20 years ago, and where protesters were successful in keeping the delegates from getting from their hotels into the convention center. Right after that, there'll be a WTO plus 20 party at the Vermilion Art Gallery and Bar with a DJ and dancing, and also Jill Friedberg's archival video footage of the protests. That's from 8 p.m. to midnight at 1508 11th Avenue. That's at 11th between Pike and Pine Streets on Capitol Hill at the Vermilion Art Gallery and Bar.
Archival footage she's been storing under her stairs for 20 years.
Yeah, apparently she had something like 400 hours of footage that she looked through. Some of it may be other folks' footage too. But that's going to definitely be worth seeing. And I think Dana Sherholtz, many of us remember Dana was a local photographer and activist who took a lot of photos of various protests around the city for years here. She was also at the WTO protests, and she's going to be there showing some of her photos as well. So that's definitely worth checking out.
All right. So we will plan on seeing you back next week then.
Yes, I'll be here next weekend, and maybe Jav will be back. We'll see.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We'll find out. Tune in to find out. Mm-hmm.